All right, Chris Giancarlo, ladies and gentlemen. Chris, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Bang, bang. Good to be with you.
All right, this is a very serious show, Chris. We have to take everything very seriously around here. Let's talk first about your time at the CFTC. You became known as Crypto Dad, now the title of your book. Walk us through, as you were, you know, kind of presiding over crypto as one of many other things, it seems like crypto became part of the conversation or became the main conversation that you guys were having. Walk us through kind of that time period.
Yeah, it's you know, it's actually fascinating because I didn't go to the CFTC to focus on crypto. I went to focus on an obscure part of the over-the-counter institutional marketplace known as swaps. And that's what I was there to try to get some of the new regulations that were imposed by Dodd-Frank to actually be well-tailored to that marketplace and to work well. But by 2014, 2015, crypto was really emerging. I talk about it in my book. I received a visit from the Winklevoss brothers and some others, the newly formed at that point Chamber of Digital Commerce, and really started leaning in and started learning and understanding this. And at first was fascinated by the whole world, including, of course, distributed ledger technology, which to me seemed like it might actually have provided a solution to the financial crisis. If we had had all of the credit exposure of the world's largest banks, the Wall Street banks, on a blockchain back in 2008, we wouldn't have had some of the policy limited choices of policy that we had. You know, at the time, it was perceived that the gross amount of exposure for a failure of Lehman Brothers would have been $400 billion in credit default protection written by the other banks on Wall Street. And they extrapolated from that if Lehman were to fail and trigger a failure of, let's say, Goldman Sachs, then that would be, say, $800 billion, and a failure of JP Morgan would be, you know, $1.2 trillion. Basically, the Feds figured out a failure of one bank could create this domino effect. Well, we now know that while the gross exposure of a failure Lehman Brothers was $400 billion, the net exposure was less than $9 billion. And that's based on research we did at the CFTC during my tenure. If we knew then, in 2008, that a failure of Lehman Brothers was $9 billion, one of the policy choices could have been the Fed could have written a check. Another policy choice would have to allow it to fail. But we didn't know that. And so we responded with the TARP program that showered the Wall Street banks with trillions of dollars of liquidity because of a fear of their failure. Well, we now know that wasn't necessary. And here's my point. If all of those exposures had been on a blockchain, we could have in real time netted them down to the net exposure and knew really where the risk was. And remember, at the end of the day, it was the fog of war. It was, you know, it was the run on the bank that caused the financial crisis because people didn't know the net exposure. They only knew the gross exposure. So the light bulbs went off for me in 2014, 2015. And at that point, the CFTC, in looking at Bitcoin under the leadership of my predecessor, Tim Massad, declared Bitcoin to be a commodity subject to CFTC jurisdiction. And then I became chairman at the beginning of 2017. And in the summer of 2017, we were approached by CME and Chicago Board Options Exchange about applications for the launch of Bitcoin futures. And that took us to a really different level. We launched Lab CFTC then to be our arm of the agency to really lean in and dig in. And ultimately, we were able to get comfortable with green lighting the launch of Bitcoin futures, which then led to a lot of actually pushback and some derision, not just in the press, but also in the industry by some of the bigger legacy players in the industry were opposed. The Industry Trade Association, the FIA, took us to task for greenlighting Bitcoin futures. And other regulators here and abroad were not pleased. And they were telling me that if we were to greenlight Bitcoin futures, we would legitimize Bitcoin. And, you know, that kind of struck with me because although I was Senate confirmed for the role, I was never elected by anybody to serve in that role. And I was honored to serve, but it wasn't for me as an unelected government, basically bureaucrat, to legitimize or not legitimize what was effectively a legal product. It was for the marketplace to legitimize it. You know, our exchanges launched thousands of products, many of which never get off the ground. It could have been the case that Bitcoin futures didn't get off the ground, and that would be the marketplace determining whether it was legitimate or not. In fact, the marketplace has endorsed the product, and Bitcoin futures have taken off. But it was not long after that decision in the spring of the winter of 2018 in February, that I was called to account for our actions before the Senate Banking Committee alongside SEC Chairman Jay Clayton. And as you do for these hearings, I prepared a 40-page explanation of basically everything we had done to greenlight Bitcoin futures, chapter and verse of why we made the decision we made. And I expected to get raked over the coals by those on, opposed at that point in 2018 to the emergence of crypto, of which there were many in the U.S. Senate. And so I was prepared for a pretty long day. And as I was looking at that testimony the night before the hearing, thinking, gosh, I can never summarize these 40 pages and hundreds of footnotes into an opening statement. So I'm just going to talk to them as a regular person. And so the next morning when the lights went on in this hearing room in front of dozens of senators and hundreds of people actually in the audience, I said, you know, senators, I know I'm here to appear before you as the head of a U.S. regulatory agency, but if you don't mind for a second, I just want to talk to you as a dad. And I explained that I had three kids then in their early 20s who had tried to interest in the stock market, you know, throughout their teenage years with no effect. But all they wanted to talk about now was crypto. And the same with my nieces and nephews. And I said, you know, senators, I think we owe it to this generation to respond to this interest, not with derision disrespect, but with real intelligence. I think we owe it to get this regulation right, to respond to this this new innovation, and quite frankly, this generational interest in it with a forward-leaning, thoughtful response. And as I just had gotten those words out of my mouth, my Twitter feed just exploded. I think I had 1,000 followers when I went into the hearing. And within, you know, 72 hours, I think I had 45,000 Twitter followers. But, you know, it was just, and that's where the name Crypto Dad came from. Some folks came up with lots of good memes. Crypto Dad was the one that seemed to stick because I had said I'm here as a dad. But the real point of it was clear to me in 2015, 2017, that this is much more than just some new fad asset class. This is really a fundamental re-architecting of financial services, of banking, and most importantly, money itself.
It's an incredible story, I think, how you got here, because this book, most people are going to read this and say, oh, I want to know what the former CFTC chairman thinks about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. They're going to read it for the stories, et cetera. One piece that I think a lot of people may not pull out of it is you use a very specific word in the subtitle, which is the fight for the future of money. The word fight is taken from people in many different ways. Is there a fight underway in the political and regulatory landscape, not only in like good or bad, should we have this, should we not, but it also seems like on the regulatory side, there's various regulatory bodies all trying to compete for who gets oversight over what, politicians all competing or fighting over who gets to be the first to do something, who gets their legislation put forward. Like, is that a fair analysis from the outside looking in?
Yeah, it really is. And it's almost like a multidimensional chessboard. Within governments, there are fights going on for regulatory turf. You know, one that folks note often is, you know, disputes between the SEC and the CFTC over jurisdiction. But it's broader than that. There are other, if you look at the executive order that came out of the Biden White House just this week on March 9th, ensuring responsible development of digital assets, it's amazing how many federal agencies and regulatory bodies and bureaus are given responsibility to formulate a policy response. It goes way beyond the market regulators of the CFTC and the SEC, but it includes the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It includes bank regulators like the FDIC and the OCC, the Office of Control of the Currency. It includes national security agencies as well. As well as a committee known as the FSOC, or the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is chaired by the Treasury Department, includes a dozen agencies as part of the U.S. agencies as part of its membership. That's before you even get the state regulators who have a stake in this. And then you have global regulators and global standard setting policies like the Financial Stability Board, which is a collection of the world's financial regulators and bank regulators and central bankers, which meets in Switzerland, of which the United States is a member, which is also mentioned in this presidential report. So just within regulators, you've got a battle for turf responsibility and authority. I think just this morning, the CFTC current chairman, Russ Benham, with whom I served, at an important speech in Boca, Florida, has talked about the CFTC defending its role in this. So that's just the regulators in this fight, but it goes even beyond them, because you've got the legacy banking system and certain portions of it, especially portions like correspondent banking, payments are also concerned about what their role is in this new what I call a new architecture of payments, a new architecture of bank services. And then you've got the population itself. And one of the things that I tried to do in my advocacy is speak to our fellow citizens that say, the future of money is being formed now. You've got a role to play in this. Issues of economic privacy, economic liberty, censorship resistance are going to be settled now. And so we've got to make sure that our fellow citizens understand that there's a scramble underway right now between regulators, between industry groups, between nations. Look what China's doing with the development of their digital yuan, and they're stamping on that development certain values that are important to them, values like state surveillance of economic activity. And they will export that technology that they are developing along with the values that they're encoding in it to many parts of the world. So what will be the values in the future of money that we developed here in a democracy that are developed in European democratic countries? Will those values prevail in the future of money? So I call it the fight because the future of money, the future of banking, the future of financial services is being developed now. And ultimately, it's going to come down to what values are going to win out in that future. And that's very much a fight that we need to be engaged in.
Absolutely. My last question before my brother's got some questions for you is around the Bitcoin spot ETF. We obviously have seen a Bitcoin futures ETF approved in the United States. There's spot ETFs that have been approved internationally. What's your read on this? And is there a reason why it hasn't been approved? Do you think that it will be approved? I'll kind of leave it open-ended in terms of what you can and can't say. But what's your general read on the spot ETF situation?
Well, look, as a former market professional, I spent 30 years in the private sector long before I went into government. I fully understand the need and the demand for a Bitcoin future based upon spot markets. And it's disappointing to me that are in economically competing nations like in Canada, Switzerland, and elsewhere. They have found their way to getting comfortable with such a product, and many U.S. investors that are looking for a hedge against price movements have to go offshore to take advantage of those products. That was something we were very concerned about when we greenlighted the Bitcoin future market ourselves here in the U.S. because we wanted to be the first. That was part of our calculus. We didn't want to get beat to the punch by other countries. And as a result, I think the United States has benefited greatly that the price, increasingly the price of Bitcoin is being set in U.S. regulated futures markets. But I must say I take a little bit of, perverse pride in the fact that the first Bitcoin futures market that the SEC was willing to use as a basis for an ETF was the one that we launched in 2017 over some vociferous objections. So it's a bit of a vindication for that decision. But I would say that I think that in the same way that regulators in Canada and elsewhere have been able to find their way to get comfortable with a ETF based upon a spot market might be a guide for how my former sister agency, the SEC, might be able to get comfortable with this in the future and meet that pent-up demand that clearly exists here in the United States because that demand is being satisfied offshore rather than onshore.
Makes sense. Joe, what questions you got?
Chris, thanks for joining us. My question would just be around regulatory clarity. We've seen a bunch of countries do different things, right? China has banned it. Other countries have bought Bitcoin. We just saw the president of South Korea is crypto-friendly when he got elected. But when it comes to the U.S. specifically, how important is it that they not only are Bitcoin-friendly and crypto-friendly, but there's clarity around regulatory decisions?
Yeah. You know what? I don't even feel regulators need to be crypto friendly. They just need to be technology neutral. And they need to recognize that 99.9% of market participants want to do the right thing. They want to operate in a regulated environment. And they just need to know what the rules are. And so I think regulators have a duty to supply the marketplace with clear guidelines, clear rules, so that the market can operate in a regulated fashion. And that's what we did at the CFTC over the course of 2017. It's almost 4 years ago now that we worked to make sure that our rule set was clear. You know, it's interesting. Not a lot of people have noted this, but I make it clear in our book. We didn't make the path easier for crypto futures. We actually came up with something we called heightened scrutiny. We put crypto futures under a higher standard of compliance. You might say we kind of, the incline of the path to regulation was slightly more inclined than other paths, but we put lights on the path so that people could follow it. We illuminated the path. We said it's a higher level, but here's how you do it. And you know what? It's worked very, very well with a number of, you know, a continuing number of successful product certifications that have been launched under CFTC. Jurisdiction. So we didn't, in a sense, say we're going to make it easier. We didn't say we're going to be necessarily crypto friendly. We said we're going to be technologically neutral. We're going to come up with a few higher standards that we felt were appropriate for crypto, but we're going to say, but here's the path. Follow the path and you can get to success. And so, you know, I think that's the right recipe. I think the job of regulators is not to make it an impossible, obscure, you know, guess right and you get lucky, guess wrong and you get an enforcement action on you. It's to say, look, here's the path. It may be a challenging path, but we've illuminated. It's clear. We've made our rule set clear to proceed and we are neutral. We, you know, if you meet our standards, bingo, you've reached the regulatory realm and good luck to you.
John, what do you got for us?
Chris, what are your thoughts around stablecoins and the involvement they can have in like future markets?
Well, look, I think stablecoins have really proven in many ways their social utility, their commercial and financial utility, and they speak for themselves. You know, when I talk about things like central bank digital currency, including the potential for a U.S. central bank digital currency, my advice to central bankers is look at the success that's already being had in stablecoins. There's so much to learn from. You know, it's funny when we talk about this re-architecting of financial services and money itself, the private sector has been at it now for almost a dozen years since the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper. And the official sector is in many ways just catching up. I think the president's executive order dated March 9th, 2020, you know, is interesting because it's almost 14 years after Satoshi Nakamoto first said, let's consider the digitization of assets, the creation of blockchain technology. And so the official sector is very much catching up. And so it would be, I think, very unfortunate for U.S. leadership in this innovation if regulators were to take a hostile or a hostile approach to stablecoins. There's so much to be learned. There's such a demand that they're satisfying now. Now, that's not to say there are not regulatory issues, and that's not to say that issues of transparency, of adequacy of disclosure, of truthfulness in claims for stablecoins are not appropriate. And during my tenure as chairman of the CFTC, we launched some look into some stable coins. Some of those have resulted in some enforcement action. There is a role for the type of regulation that I've been describing, which is a clear rules and enforcement if folks break those rules. But I do think that the innovation of stable coins is one that there's so much to learn from. There's so much to benefit from. And I think that should be the approach of the official sector in Washington.
Gotcha. Chris, before we let you go, one other big thing I think people are thinking about right now is as we come to midterm elections, as we see politicians starting to kind of put forward what we would call the crypto-friendly approach. I've literally had people reach out to me and say, hey, I'm going to make Bitcoin legal tender. Hey, I'm going to very friendly to a specific sector or a certain type of company or whatever. How much can politicians do versus the regulators? And I think that this, a lot of times for the average American, they just say like, oh, they're all the same, right? They just like, they're somewhere in Washington. But maybe just help people understand like, what should they ask of or pay attention to when it comes to politicians? And then what can they do or how should they engage with the regulators themselves if this is something they care about?
Well, thanks. And I want to actually respond with two ideas. The first one is a point I always made. Many people said to me, you're crypto friendly, Chris, you're business friendly. And I always push back on that. I don't think it's the job of any regulator to be friendly to an it's to be market intelligent. It's to be technology intelligent. It's to understand the innovation, understand the market demand, understand its role in satisfying commercial need. And if you do that, I think it's quite easy to be relatively market neutral, industry neutral. And so I don't consider myself having succeeded as a commissioner or as a chairman of an agency because I was friendly to an industry. I think to whatever degree I had success, it was because we became market intelligent, understood the demand, understood what the product served and what the industry was seeking to do. And we reacted accordingly within the rule set that had been assigned to us by Congress, which then comes to the answer to your second question. I think there's a big role for Congress. I think Congress has been largely to date absent from this discussion, and they've left it to basically regulators to, on an ad hoc basis, respond to this innovation as best they can, knowing that the statutes that those regulators, like the SEC and the CFTC, were written in the 1930s, 90 years ago. These are 90-year-old statutes written for an analog world, a face-to-face, person-to-person world, long before the internet was even conceived of. And so those statutes can only take regulators so far. And during the Trump administration, as I write about in my book, it was very much an ad hoc response to this innovation. Now the Biden administration is trying to create some degree what I would call a theme for regulators to follow. But even with that theme, regulators still only have limited statutory authority because, again, those statutes go back to the 1930s. It's time for Congress to step in with actual legislation that make it clear, first, that I believe the United States has a national imperative to be a technology leader in this re-architecting of financial services. We were the world's leader during the 20th century under the old technology. Our regulations, I mentioned they were old, but they were also first, and a lot of the world is modeled on those regulations. So we very much led in the regulatory sphere, we led in the financial sphere. American banks are still the world-leading banks, the dollar is the world-leading currency, and so the leadership we had, we now need to take to the next level. You can never rest on your laurels. We need to modernize the dollar. We need to modernize financial services. We need to modernize payments. And this new architecture is the key to doing that. So number one, I think Congress needs to make it clear that there's a national imperative for leadership in this area. And they need to tell the regulators that that is the will of the people. That's who Congress speaks for, the will of the people is that we follow the innovation. And that instruction to regulators, I think, then clarifies some ambiguity. I think to some degree, regulators have been challenged by this. One of the things that Congress needs to make clear that it's not the regulator's job to, in a sense, buttress or shore up the existing financial system against change. That would be a terrible mistake to do. And I think there's an opportunity for Congress to say, it's not the regulator's job. You talk about being friendly to crypto. It's not the regulator's job to be friendly to existing legacy analog methods. It's not their job to be friendly to crypto. It's their job to understand the change, understand the architecture, and to move with the times so that we remain in the forefront of financial innovation. And of course, we need to be on guard for fraud, manipulation, of which, look, we all know there's enough of it in this industry that needs to be cleaned up, just as there is in the legacy industry, right? Just as there is in any industry there is, but you know, it is the job of regulators to take out the bad actors so the majority of good actors can conduct their business knowing that they're not being scammed. So that job exists and will always exist. You know, financial regulation is to some degree a game of cops and robbers. You know, the robbers figure out some new technology, the cops are one step behind. And that will be always the case. But Congress needs to clarify that as well. So I think there's a real role for Congress. And I'm very optimistic that this is the year that Congress is getting up to speed, is learning. And I'm pretty optimistic that 2023 is when we'll actually see action on a lot of these congressional initiatives and perhaps some legislation.
I couldn't say it any better myself. I just put into the chat the link to Amazon to go get the book for anyone who's who's interested. Chris, this is fantastic, and as you know, I could talk to you literally for hours about this stuff because I think you nailed it with this idea that this is essential to the future of the United States, the future financial security of literally hundreds of millions of people, both here domestically, but also internationally as well, and billions of people in terms of getting this stuff right. This technology can serve a very specific purpose and is important. So I appreciate all the work that you've done at the CFTC. You know, the 30 years before in the private sector, people kind of forget about that part. It's just like, oh, CFTC, but ended up probably being a pretty good foundation. And then the book, Crypto Dad, The Fight for the Future of Money. People can go and get it. And Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, they wrote the foreword, and the back is a who's who of Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, and the blockchain industry. So congrats on all this success, and highly suggest folks go get the book.
Bob, great being with you. It's a pleasure being with you today.
Absolutely.
We'll thanks,
talk,
guys.
We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. Bang, bang.
See you, buddy.